imprisoned. I was shot with my hands in the air. I was accused of a wide variety of crimes, all of which, with the exception of the murder of a New Jersey state trooper, I was acquitted. I was tried for the murder of a New Jersey state trooper by an all-white jury in a highly prejudiced county where something like 70% of those polled already believed I was guilty. I was tried in the press for years. I was subsequently convicted. I was sentenced to life plus 30 years in prison. Plus 30 years because I would not stand up for the judge. I spent 6.5 years in prison. 2 of those 6.5 years I spent in solitary confinement in men's prisons, which was against New Jersey law. But nevertheless, that's where I was sent, and that's where I spent 2 years. And I subsequently escaped. I came to Cuba in 1984. I've been here ever since. I have written one book, which is an autobiography. I am now working on another book, which is about the ideological development of the Black Liberation Movement in the United States. And so, I would like to just open up the floor for people's questions, whether they're about Cuba, whether they're about me, whether they're about whatever. Let's see.
Is your book available?
Yes, it is. It's published by Lawrence Hill. It's available in most leftist kind of bookstores in the United States, African American bookstores, and available in England, and it's published in several other languages now. So.
Are the people in the States your sympathizers and supporters who are still working on your case? And if so, have they gotten...
Are my supporters and
supporters? Stand up, Gary, we can't hear you.
Still working on your case. Are the supporters in the States still working on using Freedom of Information Act to get access to police files or anything of that sort?
Okay. There are so many political prisoners, approximately 100, and resources are very thin. And, you know, I mean, there are not that many resources, so that most of the effort of people who supported me is now directed toward supporting other political prisoners. And like there have been, for example, if I had not escaped, I would next year be in prison, it would be 20 years. Sundia Ara Akoli, who was arrested with me, who's on the case with me, has been in prison almost 20 years. It's been 19 years. There are other political prisoners who have been in prison for 20 years, others 21, and others 22 years. For example, Geronimo Pratt will soon be in prison 22 years, and even though there's an enormous amount of evidence pointing to the fact that A, he was framed, B, the government knows he was framed, is completely innocent. I mean, there have been special given by, what is that program, 60 Minutes, he's been on 60 Minutes, agents, FBI agents have come forward and said that they know that he is innocent, that he was in fact framed by the government. The FBI has made statements saying that he was supposed to have been. And now that there are many people who are testifying that he was at a meeting of the Black Panther Party during the time when the crime was supposedly committed miles and miles away, more than 500 miles away. And the FBI says that even though he was under day-to-day surveillance, they started keeping records the day after the event, and those other records disappeared. So we're dealing with blatant violations of not only people's human rights, but of the civil rights, you know, and people are very unaware in the United States of the fact that A, that they are political prisoners, and B, that these political prisoners have been imprisoned basically since the early 70s, some of them since the late 60s. And I mean, it's criminal that they are there, and part of the reason that I believe that they are still there and that there's so little work being done around political prisoners is A, because the government still maintains a kind of COINTEL program, which part of that COINTEL program under another name is dedicated to minimizing and criminalizing the Black Liberation Movement, African people, and so that they're within the left is a kind of idea that these people must have been done something, or they're infantile leftists who are not worthy of being supported, and that these people are really not political priorities. But my question is, if we accept the government's definition of who people who struggle are, then we are in fact negating the legitimacy of the Puerto Rican liberation struggle, of the Black liberation movement, and of those anti-imperialists who have shown solidarity with oppressed people in the United States, of those people who, the people are in prison for being part of the anti-nuclear movement, for being activists in all segments of the movement. So it's not just one segment of the movement that is represented in terms of political prisoners. In my case, getting back to your question, I think that given the current administration, given the right-wing nature of the U.S. government, which seems to be moving closer and closer to fascism, there is very little hope that any court will give me justice. And I think that the same applies to other people who have been victimized by the government. I think that the only way that most political prisoners will be free is that there is a massive popular movement which demands amnesty for all of those political prisoners. And I think that in my case, I would fall under that amnesty act, but I think that, I mean, it would take a great deal of massive action to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I answered your question.
I'm curious about how you feel right now as an exile. I mean, I would guess, but hopefully tell me if I'm wrong, that as an African American, you would feel extremely alienated from a white-dominated society, white supremacist society, and then on the other hand, you're living in exile and have known many people.
I don't feel any great longing to return. I miss, on real terms, African American culture. I miss friends, family, and that's very real, and that's a kind of gap in my life. But on the other hand, adopting to Cuba, while it hasn't been easy, I've had to learn another language, and you know, you spend the first 3 or 4 years learning another language feeling like an idiot because you really can't communicate, and you communicate at such a low level, people say, you know, they kind of see you as an idiot because your conversation is kind of on an idiotic level at first. So, I mean, the language was a difficult thing to adapt to, but in terms of adapting to Cuba, it wasn't so hard because it was like, in my life, the first time that I've ever been in agreement with a government that I was in. It's the first time I've ever liked a president, I've ever listened to political speeches intensely. It was the first time I've ever lived in a society that was at peace with itself. I mean, that I felt free to walk down the street, that I felt, you know, because I'm weird. If I'm writing maybe 3 o'clock, I get the urge to take a walk. And I can do that here. I feel my neighbors look out for me. I feel part of a community. And this is a new experience for me. It's been really a very healing experience for me, actually, because being an activist in the movement, being a target in by the FBI, et cetera, being in prison, all of those things are harmful things. You know, they do things to your mind, they do things to your body, they do things to your spirit. And you, when I came to Cuba, I, for the first time, could relax enough to realize the devastating effect of what 30-some years had meant to me growing up and living in a society that was totally hostile to me as a human being, that where I was had to always look out for myself, always had to watch my back, always had to look over my shoulder, always had to be alert, always had to watch my pocketbook, look around, you know, I mean, this place for me has been a place where I learned to relax, where I learned to trust people, where I learned, and not to say I just go around trusting anybody, you know, based on nothing, but where my capability to trust other people and to reach out to other people has gone to another level, because I think that people don't realize the terrible amount of stress that is a real part of the day-to-day living in the United States, and don't realize that you're constantly, especially if you live in African American communities, your life is constantly, maybe not on the line, but it's so close to the line that you feel it. You're aware of it. You know that if you walk down a wrong street one day and you know, the siren, and you don't realize that there's a siren, and you don't look at someone running, and you don't duck fast enough, but that might be you. That, it might be over, you know, and that was one part that was wonderful. The other part was my daughter. I have a daughter that's 17, she's soon to be 18, and she was born when I was in prison, and the first time we were together, we were able to form a real mother-daughter, you know, relationship was here in Cuba, and it was very painful for her, painful for me, because we didn't know each other, and even though she knew it wasn't my fault that I wasn't with her, you know, she was angry, you left me, you know, blah, 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 and it was normal, you know, and we worked it through, we formed a very close relationship. And the Cuban people were so supportive and so understanding of every aspect of that. I mean, the teacher, you know, the first year she spoke not a word of Spanish. And the teacher knew that it would be very devastating for her to fail. So, I mean, he would come to the house every day, every other day, give her special lessons. People were just so wonderful, you know, I mean, in every single way, whether it was from finding a dancing class, from the neighbors teaching her the Cuban dances, you know, I mean, they were just great. And so we opened up and we were able to be a family. And that was, I mean, I think a very beautiful part of my life, a very painful part of my life also, but we came through it, and she's doing great. She did wonderful in school here, and so that was another part of my adjusting process in Cuba, and part that of the many things that helped me to be a much more complete human being, a much more open human being.
The other day when we were talking, you saw the pressures of living in the United States and organizing there would take on organization. And you spoke of the need for more of an understanding of the social psychology of organizations and the way people interact. And that's something that
many people in the United States have been trying to address too, about the 60s and the interaction in the different groups. I was wondering if you could develop that a bit.
People's political principles and people's personal principles are very closely interrelated and interconnected. And I think that the kind of style of struggling that I was exposed to, and everybody else, most of the people were exposed to in the 60s, was a kind of, we're revolutionaries, we must sacrifice, struggle, die if necessary, give our lives for the revolution. But in terms of knowing each other, in terms of forming supportive relationships with each other, in terms of just talking about our families, talking about our backgrounds, talking about our personal problems, that was kind of shoved to the background. People, you know, you go to the meeting, you talk about whatever it is, and you go, and you know, I have met people that I haven't seen like 20 years, and they come to Cuba, and you know, we've worked together for years, and I never really knew anything about you, and you never really knew anything about me, and it seems to me that if we're working for social change, then it's not just the structural, systematic, economic structure that we have to struggle to change. I think that people who are subjected to extreme oppression, to extreme racism, to extreme sexism, to all kinds of degrading situations, all kinds of humiliating, hostile situations, have to be affected by that. That's real. If you slap me, I feel it. If you insult me on a daily basis, I feel it. And I think that part of the struggle of oppressed people is, number one, forming more human relationships, and that we have to be able to heal as well as struggle. Because what, I mean, you know, it's not just enough to fight to tear down the old oppressive systems, but at the same time, we have to be building new ways of relating, new values that are prettier. One of the things that I found with leftists, it's like I would bring someone, I'll give you a story. A friend of mine, when I joined the Black Panther Party, which wasn't a friend, but she was the one who took me around and became friendly. She showed me how to sell papers. She showed me the ropes. And so it was like when it's cold, I said, oh, it's just too cold to stand out here and sell these Panther papers and nobody's here. So let's go into this coffee shop and get some coffee. So we were in the place drinking tea. And there were just some people there. We got into a normal conversation, and she started to talk rhetoric. And the people didn't know what she was saying. She, the Black Panther Party, the Vanguard of the people. And people didn't know what the Vanguard was. They didn't know what the lumpen proletariat was. They didn't know what the lumpen proletariat was. And I mean, she turned those people off so fast. I mean, she was like somebody that dropped right out from the moon. I mean, people could not relate to the language she was talking. They couldn't relate to the tone of voice that she was using. They couldn't relate to the arrogance that just poured out of every sentence. And it was, you know, a moment that was so negative that had just been so pleasant. And in one second, it turned something into something totally negative. So I think that in my life, I have seen that repeated in many different ways. You bring people to a political organization, they're energetic, they're angry, they're just scooped up. They want to do things, they want to work, they want to struggle, but then you put them into this kind of political never-never land with people talking in rhetoric, in codes, in words that normal people don't talk, dealing with them in a totally human indifferent way. I don't care if you didn't sleep last night. I don't care if you have a test on Monday. I don't care if your kids have no babysitter, that is not my problem. And I don't see how you can build a new society based on that kind of human interrelationship, nor do I see how you can build a strong revolutionary movement based on those kinds of interrelationships. So I do think that changing how we deal with each other and healing is a very important way, of important area of struggle. I think that in the history of the World Revolutionary Movement, we have often followed European models and to the exclusion of other models of struggle. And I think that one of the things that needs to be done is that the old concept of that we have all the formulas, that all the areas of struggle are lined up, and that revolution is like this recipe that you just have to follow. Well, all of that had people kind of have come to the realization that that no longer works. But I think that when you look at how stagnated the social sciences have been, sociology, I'm talking about revolutionary social sciences, psychology, sociology, anthropology, that these have all been areas that in many of the socialist countries that have not been developed to any great degree, or they have simply copied models that have been at the forefront in the Western context. So I think that when I talk about healing and when I talk about the social sciences, because I don't see the, like psychology as just belonging to professional psychology. I don't see healing as just belonging to a medical context. I see healing as being a process of community. I see healing as there must be, people have to rediscover traditional ways of healing that exist in many different societies and combine those traditional ways of healing and traditional ways of psychological adjustment with more Western standard kinds of ways of changing people's psychology of healing. Because I think that part of what is wrong is that in many countries there is this total alienation. In many communities, people have no community. There are no doors that they can open. So you see these people who are so traumatized that they're afraid to talk to anybody, afraid to look anybody in the eye just because of the level of violence. And so that alienation is such a real process, but I don't see how we can struggle unless we really deal with that on a political level and on a personal level. I think that it is unrealistic to think that there's not going to be anger, that there's not going to be antagonism, that there is not going to be struggle when white folks, black folks, Latinos work together, whether it's in the same organization or out of the same organization. I would be crazy if I said that I am not angry about racism. I would be crazy if I said that I were not affected by racism. In a racist society, in a society that is controlled by white supremacy, then the reality of that is all people who live in that society are affected by it. I can't live it would be crazy for me to say that I have lived in a society for 30-something years. I'm 46 now, but I'm talking about the years that I lived in the United States. Without incorporating feelings of inferiority. I was not responsible for those feelings of inferiority, but they came from every aspect. I had to be affected by them. I had to have internalized them to some degree. My part of my healing process is struggling against them. And I, at this stage, after being a political activist all my life, after being, a person who has consciously try to struggle against those feelings. I cannot say that that struggle is over. I must struggle against all of the feelings of inferiority, of inadequacy that the society has heaped on me as an African and as a woman. The same is true for white people. Now, I think it's crazy for white people to say, I have lived in a white society that is where white supremacy is the religion, is official and unofficial, is the policy of the government, is the policy of the president, is in all the textbooks, is in all the movies, is in all the billboards, and say, I ain't been affected by that. That's why. That is totally untrue. So we have to admit that we have all grown up in not in this, only in the same world that has been controlled by white supremacy, Eurocentrism. That is a reality. What we both have to do is work against that on a personal level and on a political level, and to be honest about it. I would be crazy if I said that I, you know, it's like when I was in prison, one of the guards, as she tearing up my cell, throwing my clothes down, stepping on them, smashing them, said, "You don't like white people, do you?" I looked at her, why in the world do you think I should like white people? What is it? You know, that you, I might, there might be individual white people that I do in fact like because of my experiences with them personally. But if you're going to ask me overall, do I like white people, then I would have to say my experience with white people in the United States on an overall general level has not been a friendly face, a helpful hand, an open arm. That has not been my experience. So if I were to negate that reality and pretend that I had another reality, then I would be, in fact, sick, crazy. It would be a form of denial. You know, so I think that the way that we work together, the way that we deal with each other, the way that we try to come to some unity is to say, put the cards on the table. To say, let's struggle together. Let's take principled positions. And then after we do a good job of that, after we both work on what our education has been, and that, I think, is a lifelong process. I don't think that you can reach a point and say, well, I'm not racist, I'm not affected by racism, I'm not affected by white supremacy. Because I think that that is to say I am not affected by the environment. I don't think that's a Marxist position.
It's about race relations in Cuba and how you've worked through some of the issues that you've just discussed in the U.S. context.
Mm-hmm.
And whether you see any significant changes in race relations over this 8 years that you've been here.
Well, I'm going to say, first of all, that I'm never satisfied. If you ask me if I am satisfied at the speed and at the level that solving the race problem and the conditions of Africans on this earth, it is never fast enough for me, it is never enough for me. Having said that, let me talk about Cuba. I think that, well, when I first came to Cuba, people were much more, or at least I felt that people were much more hesitant about dealing with the question of race relations, about dealing with problems in Cuba, and about dealing with the history of race relations in Cuba. I felt that people were much more defensive, and that it was like kind of, we're all Cubans. After the, not this last Congress, I think it was the third Congress, which happened shortly after I came here, that changed somewhat because Fidel talked about the fact that it was important to deal with race. It was important that the number of people who are in powerful positions should reflect the composition of the population. I feel, and I felt at that time, that Cuba was taking important steps in changing that, giving Afro-Cuban or African-Cuban culture, religion, respect that it had not given before. I think that African Cubans have changed somewhat and become more identified with Africa. And I also think that in this particular time, although it's far from being perfect, I think that there's a real interest in dealing with Africa, Asia, and Latin America in a whole other context, in terms of studying the ideological input of African, Asians, and Latin Americans. I think that there is a kind of barefoot, for lack of other words, socialist kind of movement that is very young, I think, but that is moving up, that really wants to focus on a third world ideological position, that really wants to focus in on the history of Latin America, the history of Africa, the history of Asia in a much more profound way, and I see that as positive. I do not think that it is realistic to think that in 30-something years, all of the problems that existed in a society that was based on slave labor for hundreds of years can be solved. I believe that the government and the party have a absolute commitment to eradicating racism. I also feel that in the special period that has taken a back burner to survival in terms of, and I think that the struggles of women, many other struggles, even though they are important and interrelated, have been put on the back burner, and now the key issue is for the revolution to survive. So, I mean, that, I don't know if I answered all of your question, but that's kind of a woman's kind.
Yeah, that just reminded me that we were talking the other day about a little bit about how you felt about your daughter being here and some of the roles for boys and girls and gender issues. And so I just wondered if you could say a little bit about the difference between sexism or, you know, relations between men and women here and in the States, and how, what your experience has been like about the differences.
Well, I mean, my daughter she's more grown up now, but she was, when she came to Cuba, this like athletic New York kid that plays handball, that's used to punch ball, that kind of stuff. And it was, you know, very difficult because Macho is very alive and well. And so, you know, like we would look outside of our window and the boys would be playing basketball and volleyball and what they call four corners, which is like a version of punch bowl. And there would be no girls. You know, girls would be inside doing their homework. And so it was very frustrating for her in that sense to make an adjustment. Well, she became involved in I took her to the stadium where they had classes for girls, and she was like doing track and field, but she didn't like that so much. But I mean, it was only, I mean, they were great athletes in terms of girls, but it was just like mostly in the sports schools or programs that were geared to developing athletes that would, you know, compete, not just in recreational sports. Because boys in Cuba are much more into recreational sports than girls. And there's a still kind of attitude where girls stay in the house, where girls don't are not that physical. And like we would, you know, a couple of times, I would, like one time I actually had to go to school because, you know, she came home from school one day, she was in the sixth grade, and I said, well, what did you do? We had gym. So I said, what did you do? Well, we ate bread. I said, well, you ate bread? You mean you ate bread? Well, the boys played baseball and we ate bread. So I went to the school and I said, look, bread eating is not a sport. I would like my daughter to, you know, be physically developed as well as mentally developed. And I believe that's one of the principles of integral development in socialism. So would you please put that into practice? And I don't mean, you know. And so finally the teacher understood and we got it together and there was no more incidents of bread eating at gym time. But I mean, it's a struggle, and I think that women have to struggle really hard within the revolution to change the day-to-day practice, because the family code is real, it exists. When the men in Cuba, they get married, they swear up and down, they're gonna do this, they're gonna do that, and they get home and they, would you please get me a beer? You know, I mean, it's this, and women have to struggle because it's, I mean, the Cuban women, for me, are the strongest, most capable human beings probably on the face of the earth. I mean, they work, they do guard duty, they are activists in the CDR, they're activists in the Federation, they do, you know, they're responsible basically for the day-to-day care of children, they're responsible for cooking, cleaning, etc. Like, the men on my block, you see them there across the street playing dominoes, you know, and sometimes I just make them feel bad, you know, they say, oh, don't come and talk bad about us. But, you know, I mean, it's really, you know, women have really got to struggle because, you know, and under this special period, it's worse because the lines are longer, it takes longer to wait on the, for the bus. And I mean, it's a huge amount of work that women do. And I think that women are responding and are really, you know, the situation itself is forcing women to struggle in ways that they have never struggled before. My neighbor, for the first time, she came over to me, she said, I told him he got to go to the store himself. I am not a slave. He can, you know, and she went off, and I had never seen her go off like that, but she sure enough went off, and he sure enough went to the store. You know, but I mean, the macho culture that the revolution inherited is very deeply embedded, and it, I believe, is going to take a great deal of struggle and solidarity and unity on between women to get rid of it. But then I also want to put that in a historical context, because like I've talked to women from the Federation, and you know, when I came down here, it was like, what is this? You know, like it was International Day of Women, and it was like, you know, queen for a day. You know, they would bring us the trays, and they had little flowers on the trays, and I said, well, where's the militancy? Where's the, you know? And, you know, I couldn't really understand the Federation. I couldn't understand the movement of women until people started to explain to me the reality of where they came from. I mean, people, women who were activists in the Federation at the beginning had to go and literally beg people to let women work in the street. You know, that, I mean, they couldn't talk about equality. They had to talk first about men helping women, because that was the objective reality where they were. And so that it was a process that they had to go from one step to step two to step three. And that, you know, people from the U.S. and developed capitalist countries think, well, you know, that their situation can be transferred to other countries just mechanically, and that other people can be at the same level of consciousness and deal with the same kinds of ways of struggling. But I had a very good friend who was studying here from Ethiopia, and she said, she was in the Women's Caucus, and she said, you know, I wake up sometime and I really find my face wet, and I find I've been crying. She said, you know, because I know we made some very serious mistakes when we first started. She said, I would invite women to meetings, and I would invite a male speaker in a room full of women. Mm-hmm. And because of just those women, of those meetings, women were killed. Their husbands killed them for being in a room with another man. Those were the conditions that she had to struggle under, and that was the objective reality that she was dealing with. And so I learned in Cuba from just talking to women from so many different experiences, the levels of machismo in the world, and that each struggle has to be dealt with based on where it is, and using the cultural roots, using the reality not of European models, but using the homegrown stuff to begin to take the movement to a higher level. And that was a very important lesson for me to learn, so that I would be able to appreciate other people's struggles, not from my point of view and not from the things that shape my consciousness, but from their consciousness. And so I've learned a lot here, not just from Cubans, but from many people that I have met here who have explained to me realities that I would have never understood about the third world and about what struggling in other conditions means. And it's so easy, we often think that, you know, our reality is the same as other people's, only they are poor, but that's a crazy way to look at other people's struggles. I think that we have to become much more sensitive to the objective conditions that other people are dealing with and to the strengths that other people have, because I also have found that I've met people who come from African villages who, you know, we might go there and say, well, that village is primitive, but the people who are there seem to me so much more sophisticated in human ways of dealing with each other, have obtained so much more in terms of how they interrelate, of how they keep promises, and of how they relate to the society. In some African societies, for example, lying is a crime, punished not by prison, but by go away. You want to lie, we don't want to live with you. You would please go somewhere else, because we really cannot deal with that, and we cannot trust you, so that when you are ready to come home, we will make a ceremony for you. But we will not live with you as you are. And so that I have learned also that there's much to be learned from the cultures of other people, much to be learned from the history of other people. And I think that when you begin to respect the achievements, historical achievements of many people, then we will have learned a lot. And I think that it's very important that we focus on many of the things that we have not studied and have not delved into when we look for models of how to create a better society, because I think there are many lessons to be learned that are not in Marx, Lenin, etc., but that come from the traditional ways of living in of third world people. And I think that that has been an area that has been sorely neglected.
I'm curious about how you, the news that you get from the United States, how Cuban media presents it, particularly if you could perhaps touch upon the coverage of the events that followed the acquittal of the four white policemen who beat Mr. Rodney King, and how that, I guess I'm particularly interested in what you see as the strengths and if there are any weaknesses in the way in which Cuban media present information about that killing.
In terms of Rodney King, for example, the tape of Rodney King being beaten was shown in Cuba several times. Almost all Cubans saw that on the news. And most Cubans were shocked that there was an acquittal. You know, I mean, that was... of course, the news was dealt with on the normal television, and then they dedicated several programs just dealing with the verdict and dealing with the reality of police brutality and repression in the United States. They also, there was an act of solidarity with our movement, to which I was invited and I spoke, by OSPAL. That is the a committee in solidarity with Africa, Asian, Latin America. And the response was overwhelming. People were really indignant and were in one way believed that it was naked, you know, because it's very difficult for black young people who have, who look at all movies, who look at, you know, these high school movies, and they have the high school kids running around in these convertibles, and they live in these perfect houses with these perfectly manicured lawns, and, you know, and they, you open the door into their TV movie rooms, and they have all these wonderful posters and all this electrical equipment and all this stuff. So I think that many parents and many adults were like just grateful that, you know, that it was exposed, that it was naked, that the racism was exposed, so they could deal with these issues. In terms of news coverage in general, I think that it could be much better, but I think that they're dealing with a hell of a difficult job, because in the first place, there's no, you know, there's a big problem with paper. So many of the magazines that dealt with in-depth analysis of things are not being published. The amount of time that TV is being aired has been greatly reduced because of the problem with energy. And so that the amount of coverage, that in-depth coverage that they can give to any news is limited. So I think that that's a problem. I also think that Cuban people are very sophisticated in that they are very much capable of differentiating between the U.S. people and the U.S. government, and they don't confuse the two, which I think is important. And I think it's also, it's a result of the way in which they covered the U.S. historically. I don't know if I answered all of your questions.
On that same line, then, Radio Marti, what is the effect of that?
I don't know. I mean, I really do not know how much of an effect Radio Marti has, because I mean, I know some people listen to it. Some people listen to it with total skepticism. Other people listen to it with total gullibility. And other people listen to it somewhere in between. Other people don't listen to it at all. But I really do not know and have no way of knowing how many people, how effective or ineffective it is.
you address the growth of the Cuban exile community in Miami and the rest of the United States in terms of increasing inequality in Cuba and attacking the moral foundations of the revolution?
In terms of the growing inequality in Cuba?
In terms of sending goods and money back, that type of thing.
Can I address the...
Yeah, you see now the different groups that used to be really poor now have changed, and that this a support from outside in relationship to the revolution now are beginning to attack the moral foundations themselves.
To be honest, I don't know too much about what is going on in relation, you know, in the exile community in the U.S. you're talking about, right? I really don't know a lot, and I don't want to just give you a silly answer, so I'll just pass on that because I really can't give you any in-depth answer, and I don't feel that I'm capable of giving you a solid answer. And Lenin were both brilliant people, Anglos, and made contributions to what I hope in the future will be revolutionary political science or social, scientific socialism. But I think that it is pure idealism to think that the thinking of a small group of people who lived in a specific time frame can be the totality of what is a scientific revolutionary way for analyzing existing capitalism and for constructing future models of socialism. I think that, what I see right now is that revolutionary social science is in its very primitive stage. If we look at, if someone thousands of years from now would give a name to what has happened over the past 80 years in terms of the communist movement, the socialist movement, they would probably call it the pre-primitive phase of socialism. I don't think that the ideological input can come from such a narrow base and be a guide for world revolutionary struggle. I think that it's kind of like someone who is a biologist being a Darwinist, or someone who is a physicist being an Einsteinist, or you know, I mean, it's a very limited approach to the growth of a science that is out of the reality of that we're dealing with in its very infancy. I think that the approaches to what we call now Marxism-Leninism have been to recite rather than to analyze the words and the contribution of Marx and Lenin in a more broadening sense, and constantly increasing the input of other thinkers, of other revolutionary experiences. I think that people have dealt with it in with a kind of religious style, and with a kind of, you know, like the Bible. These are the only books that where you can find truth. I think that there's no question that they made tremendous contributions, but I think that for Marxism, Leninism to become a universal revolutionary science must have a way to grow, a systematic way to grow, because if a science does not in fact grow, then it is stuck at the point of dogma. I think that if it does not reflect the experiences and the intellectual, ideological, practical input from a worldwide experience, then it cannot claim to be a universal revolutionary science. So although I think it's great that they make great contributions, but there is so much room for growth and so many things that have not been developed that need to be developed. I think that we would be kidding ourselves to say that this is, you know, a complete integral way of looking at the world. I think it's just a beginning, and it reflects a very small step in what needs to be leaps and bounds.
There are over 12,000 deserters and people who went AWOL.
Who are the sectors?
And who apply for Congress resistance. And over 80% of them are people of color. Which in my view is why the two main factions in the movement did not support. The resistors in any meaningful way. They did not raise that as issues throughout the whole war. We had whole platoons deserting of in New Orleans and elsewhere of black people. And this is very different during the Vietnam War. And so the response of the white peace establishment was different.
La respuesta al partimiento de la paz por los blancos fue diferente.
But at the same time, we're also criticized for being in the service when that's the only economic, for many feel that's the only economic way of surviving.
Pero también es que, por otro lado, se nos critica por estar en el servicio militar cuando eso es una de las pocas formas que hay de sobrevivir económicamente.
And also, like, many African Americans, although they were opposed to war, they had the yellow ribbons because they had so many families that were in the
service. Era también ver el mundo a los norteamericanos usando un botón de paz, un símbolo de paz y un símbolo de que era la esta banda amarilla. O sea, usaban las dos cosas.
And what is the way to reflect
the
community versus the state in terms of the
military application? Una de las formas en que la supremacía blanca trabaja en cuando vemos la cuestión de las emociones militares.
If the dominant population perceives the fighters to be the ground troops mostly black or Latino or Native
American. Es que ven que los que están en combate directo, o sea, las tropas de infantería sean fundamentalmente negros, latinos.
And those that they are fighting against or invading are also seen as Arab or Latin Americans.
Y estas gente que ellos están invadiendo también se ven, o son afroamericanos, son latinos, también son personas de ese mundo.
That it disconnects because it does not identify with those people as being human or equals in charge.
Entonces eso se desconecta, porque no identifican a esas personas como seres, como que sean totalmente humanos, totalmente blancos.
So if you were to mobilize against U.S. intervention,
entonces si nos movilizáramos en contra de la intervención norteamericana,
you would have to be able to achieve mobilizing against white.
Era tener capaces de movilizarse y hacer una crítica acerca de la situación.
As a matter of fact, many whites on the left,
o sea, muchos blancos en la izquierda,
use the third world,
usan el tercer mundo, in particular Cuba, particularmente Cuba, as a surrogate. As a substitute for addressing the domestic third world in the United States.
Para dirigirse al ese mundo nacional dentro de Estados Unidos.
As a matter of fact, they don't even address the Puerto Ricans, the Chicanos, the African Americans, the indigenous people, but there will be supporters of Cuba and Nicaragua and Vietnam.
No solo en contra de las minorías puertorriqueñas y los hispanos, sino también en contra de los que apoyan a casos como la Cuba, la Nicaragua, la Vietnam.
And so they come back as experts.
Forma para discusión o para establecer un punto de partida.
We can use that as a basis for our starting point for discussion.
Ayer hemos estado debatiendo cuestiones que tienen que ver con el hecho de que Cuba, por primera vez en la historia de las sociedades multiraciales, fue posible eliminar el racismo que yo he dado en llamar institucionalizado. O racismo de tipo estructural. En el eje horizontal de las relaciones raciales.
I was saying yesterday that on the horizontal axis of racial relations.
En el eje de las relaciones interpersonales.
I referred to the interpersonal relations.
Todavía existe en Cuba el fenómeno del prejuicio.
We still have that phenomenon of prejudice in Cuba.
No como fenómeno meramente residual.
Not as a merely residual phenomenon.
Sino que existen mecanismos en la sociedad cubana.
But that there are mechanisms within the Cuban society.
Que todavía están reproduciendo el prejuicio.
Which are still reproducing prejudice.
Y sobre esta base,
and on this basis,
es posible a ese nivel interpersonal el ejercicio de la discriminación.
I think it is possible on that interpersonal level of relationship the exercising of racism.
Hemos avanzado mucho, hemos cambiado, hemos transformado en muchos sentidos la sociedad cubana.
We have developed a lot, we have transformed Cuban society in many.
Y en Cuba, los marxistas cubanos,
in good faith,
eliminando ese racismo
institucional. Lamentablemente.
I've not been, we regret that.
Investigado y debatido sus oportunidades.
These issues have not been researched and discussed deeply.
Porque se partió el falso presupuesto.
Because there was this false
de la que
assumption
de que la eliminación de la base económico-social es
that the elimination of the socio-economic basis for racism and the prohibition of racism by law right after the triumph of revolution that all these bases would eliminate racism automatically.
We
still have 2 minutes. 2 more minutes. I'd like to remind the U.S. delegation that in the present Cuban Constitution, the current Cuban Constitution, chapter 5 on equality, chapter 5 on equality, give us an insight on the racial problems of the United States, which I believe are of the racial problems in the United States, which I consider are completely different from the problems we have in our country. No, I agree with what Loni Hilton stated and what Lopez Oliva stated, that racial prejudice has not been eliminated, and that many times we have believed that by creating material basis and legal basis for the elimination of discrimination, true that we could find on an interpersonal level individuals who discriminate. Though at the level of society, at the level of the team to me when I was listening to the presentation of the American conference, that there are two nations within the United States. One nation, one white nation, and another nation for white, for Latinos, for Afro-Americans, for
Native Americans.
No solo porque no tienen reconocido.
Not only because these minorities have their rights not recognized, but also because I believe the Cuban woman take a poquito con nosotros. Because I believe that the rights of these people have not been acknowledged, and that these minorities have not been integrated in the process of the formation of our own
national.
Two, 3 days ago, Leonito was saying, and I reassert this, that from 70 to 80% of the Cuban population was either white or black, but mixed. Many of us who have white looks, and López Oliva was saying something about that, and I am saying the same thing. Many of those of us who have white looks are not that white. Because in the process of formation of the Cubans as a people, there is a very intense mix. And many of our most relevant characters and people in our history have contributed with their action and with their works to eliminate this problem. And one example is José Martí, who fought immensely to integrate the black population into the struggle for the independence, and also the existence of one leader, as for example Antonio Maceo, who was the chief, who was lieutenant general of the independentist army, and he was allowed
to be carried on, you know, the criminal and a discriminatory one.
Y llamábamos la atención cómo de una u otra forma esa tendencia se iba a reflejar en la conciencia común.
And we were insisting on the fact that this one of these two tendencies, or how these two tendencies would be reflected in the common consciousness.
Creo inclusive cuando abordamos el prejuicio en las condiciones de nuestro país.
I think that when we talk about prejudices in the conditions of our country,
debemos abordarlo con el carácter contradictorio que este pueda tener.
We have to talk about this, or with taking into account the contradictory character that it has.
O sea, este no se manifiesta de una forma llena.
It's not manifested in a full way,
directa,
direct way,
sino que se expresa a través de contradicciones y mediaciones en la propia, en el propio individuo.
It's expressed through contradictions and mediations within the individual.
Inclusive en el propio individuo discriminador.
Even in the very discriminating.
A veces inclusive individual.
The movement of the color independence in 1902 was an armed movement that has an objective to eliminate.